Cooking food in salted water is one of the simplest ways to season from within. Taste roasted potatoes that were seasoned with salt as they went into the oven, and you'll taste salt on the surface, but not much farther in. But taste potatoes that were simmered in salted water for a little while before being roasted, and you'll be shocked by the difference. Salt will have made it all the way into the center, doing its powerful work of seasoning from within along the way. Salt pasta water, potato cooking water, and pots of grains and legumes as early as possible to allow salt to dissolve and diffuse evenly into the food. Season the water for vegetables correctly, and you won't have to add salt again before serving. Salads made with boiled vegetables, be it potatoes, asparagus, cauliflower, green beans, or anything else, are most delicious when the vegetables are seasoned properly while they're cooking. Salt sprinkled on top of one of these salads at the time of serving won't make as much of a difference in flavor as it will in texture by adding a pleasant crunch. Salt meats that are going to be cooked in water, like any meats, in advance, but season the cooking liquids for stews, braises, and poached meats conservatively. Keep in mind that you'll be consuming any salt you add here. While some salt may leach from the seasoned meat into the less savory broth, it will have already done its important tenderizing work. Anticipate the flavor exchange that will happen between the seasoned meat and its cooking liquid, and taste and adjust the liquid, along with the meat, before serving. Keep on listening to learn more about the nuances of blanching, braising, simmering, and poaching in the heat chapter. Diffusion calculus. The three most valuable tools to encourage salt diffusion are time, temperature, and water. Before setting out to cook, as you choose an ingredient or a cooking method, ask yourself, how can I season this from within? Then use these variables to plot out how far in advance and how much to salt your food or cooking water. Time. Salt is very slow to diffuse. If you are cooking something big or dense and want to get salt into it, season the ingredient as early as possible to give salt the time to travel to the center. Temperature. Heat stimulates salt diffusion. Salt will always diffuse more quickly at room temperature than in the fridge. Use this fact to your advantage when you've forgotten to salt your chicken or steak in advance. Pull the meat out of the fridge when you get home, salt it, and let it sit out while the oven or grill preheats. Water. Water promotes salt diffusion. Use watery cooking methods to help salt penetrate dense, dry, and tough ingredients, especially if you don't have time to season them in advance. Using salt. The British food writer Elizabeth David once said, "I do not even bother with a salt spoon. I am not able to see what is unmannerly or wrong with putting one's fingers into the salt." I agree. Get rid of your shaker, dump the salt in a bowl, and start using your fingers to season your food. You should be able to fit all five fingers into your salt bowl and easily grab a palmful of salt. This important but often unsaid rule of good cooking is so routine for professional cooks that when working in an unfamiliar kitchen, we instinctively hunt for containers to use as salt bowls. When pressed, I've even used coconut shells to hold salt. I once taught a class at the National Cooking School in Cuba. The state-run kitchen was so barren that I ended up sawing plastic water bottles in half to use for holding salt and other garnishes. It got the job done. Measuring salt. Abandoning precise measurements when using salt requires an initial leap of faith. When I was first learning how to cook, I always wondered how I'd know when I'd added enough. I wondered how I'd avoid using way too much. It was discombobulating. And the only way to know how much salt to use was to add it incrementally and taste with each addition. I had to get to know my salt. With time, I learned that a huge pot of pasta water required 3 handfuls to start. I figured out that when I seasoned chickens for the spit, it should look like a light snowstorm had fallen over the butchering table. It was only with repetition and practice that I found these landmarks. I also found a few exceptions. Certain pastry, brine, and sausage recipes, where all of the ingredients are precisely weighed out, don't need constant adjusting. But I still salt every other thing I cook to taste. The next time you're seasoning a pork loin for roasting, pay attention to how much you use, and then take a moment when you take your first bite to consider if you got the seasoning right. If so, Commit to memory the way the salt looked on the surface of the meat. If not, make a mental note to increase or decrease the amount of salt next time. You already possess the very best tool for evaluating how much salt to use, a tongue. Conditions in the kitchen are rarely, if ever, identical twice. Since we don't use the same pot every time or the same amount of water, the same size chicken or number of carrots, measurements can be tricky. Instead, rely on your tongue and taste at every point along the way. With time, you'll learn to use other senses to gauge how much salt to use. Touch, sight, and common sense can be just as important as taste. The late, great Marcella Hazan, who authored the indispensable essentials of classic Italian cooking, could tell when a dish needed more salt by simply smelling it. My general ratios for measuring salt are simple. 1% salt by weight for meats, vegetables, and grains, and 2% salinity for water for blanching vegetables and pasta. To see what these numbers translate to by volume for various salts, take a look at the chart in the accompanying PDF. If using the amounts of salt I prescribe terrifies you, try a little experiment. Set up 2 pots of water and season one as you normally would. Season the other to 2% salinity and note what it feels and looks like to use that much salt. Cook half of your green beans, broccoli, asparagus, or pasta in each pot of water and compare the flavor when you eat them. I suspect the taste test will be enough to convince you to trust me. Consider these ratios a starting point. Soon, maybe just after 1 or 2 pots of pasta, you'll be able to judge how much salt is enough by trusting the way the grains feel as they fall from your palm and whether or not, upon tasting, you're transported to the sea. How to salt. Once you realize how much salt it takes to season something properly, you might start to believe that there's no such thing as too much. This happened to me. I remember when a chef I particularly admired walked into the downstairs butchery room where I'd been sent to season pork roasts for the following night's dinner. Having recently come to appreciate the power of salt, I decided that in order to cover the roasts evenly, I'd roll them in a huge bowl of salt to ensure that every surface was adequately coated. As she came down the stairs, her eyebrows shot up. I'd been using enough salt to cure the roasts for 3 years. They'd be completely inedible the next night. I spent the next 20 minutes rinsing the salt off the meat. Later, the chef showed me the proper hand grasp for distributing salt evenly on large surfaces. I didn't understand the nuances of the act of salting until I began paying attention to the various ways cooks used salt in different situations. There was the way we salted pots of water for blanching vegetables or pasta with near abandon, adding palmful after palmful, only to await its dissolution, lightly skimming a finger across the rolling boil, tasting thoughtfully, and more often than not, adding even more. There was the way we seasoned trays of vegetables, lined up duck legs butchered for confit, even larger cuts of meat, and pans of focaccia ready for the oven. This was done by lightly grasping the salt in your upturned palm, letting it shower down with a wag of the wrist. This grasp, not the hovering pinch I was used to, was the way to distribute salt, flour, or anything else granular, evenly and efficiently over a large surface. Practice the wrist wag in your own kitchen, over a piece of parchment paper, or on a cookie sheet. Get used to the way the salt falls from your hands. Experience the illicit thrill of using so much of something we've all been taught to fear. First, dry your hands so the salt won't stick to your skin. Grab a palmful of salt and relax. Jerky or robotic hand motions make for uneven salting. See how the salt lands. If it lands unevenly, then it means you're seasoning your food unevenly. Pour the salt back into the bowl and try again. The more your wrist flows, the more evenly the salt will land. This isn't to say that you never want to use a pinch of salt, which can be used like a nail polish size bottle of touch-up car paint to fix a scratch on a fender. It might not have much potential to repair major damage, but applied precisely and judiciously, it will yield flawless results. Use a pinch when you want to make sure each bite is salted just so. Slices of avocado atop a piece of grilled bread, halved hard-cooked eggs, or tiny perfect caramels. But try to attack a chicken or a tray of butternut squash slices with the pinch, and your wrist will give out long before you're done. Salt and pepper. While it's true that where there's pepper, there should almost always be salt, the inverse isn't necessarily so. Remember, salt is a mineral and an essential nutrient. When salted, food undergoes a number of chemical reactions that change the texture and flavor from within. Pepper, on the other hand, is a spice, and proper spice usage is primarily guided by geography and tradition. Consider whether pepper belongs in a dish before you add it. Though French and Italian cooks make abundant use of black pepper, not everyone does. In Morocco, shakers of cumin are commonly set on the table along with salt. In Turkey, it's usually some form of ground chili powder. In many Middle Eastern countries, including Lebanon and Syria, it's the blend of dried thyme, oregano, and sesame seeds known as za'atar. In Thailand, sugar can be found alongside chili paste, while in Laos, guests are often brought fresh chilies and limes. It doesn't make any more sense to automatically season everything with pepper than it would to add cumin or za'atar to every dish you cook. To learn more about spices used around the world, refer to the World of Flavor in the accompanying PDF. When you do use black pepper, look for telecherry peppercorns, which ripen on the vine longer than other varieties and therefore develop more flavor. Grind them at the last moment onto a salad, a toast smeared with creamy burrata and drizzled with oil, sliced ripe tomatoes, pasta cacio e pepe, or slices of perfectly cooked steak. Add a few whole peppercorns to a brine, braise, sauce, soup, stock, or pot of beans as you set it on the stove or slip it into the oven. In liquid, an early addition of whole spices initiates a flavor exchange. As the spices absorb liquid, they relinquish some of their volatile aromatic compounds, gently flavoring the liquid in a way that a little sprinkle at the end of cooking could never achieve. Spices, like coffee, always taste better when ground just before use. Flavor is locked within them in the form of aromatic oils, which are released upon grinding and again upon heating. The slow leak of time causes pre-ground spices to relinquish flavor. Purchase whole spices whenever you can and grind them with a mortar and pestle or spice grinder as you use them to experience the powerful release of aromatic oils. You'll be astonished by what a huge difference it makes in your cooking. Salt and sugar. Don't abandon everything you know about salt when you turn to making dessert. We're taught to think of salt and sugar existing in contrast to, rather than in concert with, one another. Food is either sweet or savory. But remember that the primary effect salt has on food is to enhance flavor, and even sweets benefit from this boost. Just as a little sweetness can amplify flavors in a savory dish, whether in the form of caramelized onions, balsamic vinaigrette, or a spoonful of applesauce served with pork chops, salt will also improve a sweet dessert. To experience what salt does for sweets, divide your next batch of cookie dough and omit salt from half. Taste cookies from both batches side by side. Because salt will have done its aroma and taste-enhancing work, you'll be astounded by the notes of nuttiness, caramel, and butter you detect in the salted cookies. The foundational ingredients of sweets are some of the blandest in the kitchen. Just as you'd never leave flour, butter, eggs, or cream unseasoned in a savory dish, so should you never leave them unseasoned in a dessert. Usually, just a pinch or two of salt whisked into a dough, batter, or base is enough to elevate flavors in pie and cookie doughs, cake batters, tart fillings, and custards alike. Considering how you plan to eat a dessert can help you decide which type or types of salt to use. For example, use fine salt that will dissolve evenly in chocolate cookie dough, and then top it with a flakier one such as Maldon for a pleasant crunch. Layering salt. From capers to bacon to miso paste to cheese, there are many sources of salt beyond the crystals we add directly into our food. Working more than one form of salt into a dish is what I call layering salt, and it's a terrific way to build flavor. When layering salt, think about the dish as a whole and consider all of the various forms of salt you hope to add before you begin. Neglecting to account for the later addition of a crucial salty ingredient could result in oversalting. Think of layering salt the next time you make Caesar dressing, which has several salty ingredients. Anchovies, Parmesan, Worcestershire sauce, and salt. Garlic, which I like to pound with a pinch of salt in a mortar and pestle into a smooth paste, is a fifth source of salt. Since making a delicious, balanced dressing depends on working in the right amount of each of those and other unsalted ingredients, Refrain from adding salt crystals until you're sure that you've added the right amount of everything else. First, make a stiff unsalted mayonnaise by whisking oil into egg yolks drop by drop. Next, work in initial amounts of pounded anchovies, garlic, grated cheese, and Worcestershire. Then, add vinegar and lemon. Taste. It will need salt. But does it also need more anchovy, cheese, garlic, or Worcestershire? If so, add salt in the form of any of those ingredients. But do it gradually, stopping to taste and adjust with acid as needed. It may take several rounds of tasting and adjusting to get it right. As with any dish with multiple forms of salt, add crystals only after you're satisfied with the balance of all other flavors. And to be sure you've gotten it right, dip a lettuce leaf or two into the finished dressing to taste, to ensure that the combination delivers the zing you're after. Even when following a recipe, if you realize that a dish needs more salt, take a moment to think about where that salt should come from. Balancing salt. No matter how attentive you are while cooking, there will be times you sit down to eat only to discover that you've underseasoned your dinner. Some foods forgive undersalting more readily than others. You can easily adjust a salad at the table with a pinch of salt. Stir a shaving of salty Parmesan into a cup of soup to bump up its seasoning. Other foods don't respond as well. No amount of salty sauce or cheese or meat could ever make up for bland pasta. The tongue will always know the water was nowhere nearly as salty as the sea. Roasted and braised meats cannot pardon the transgression of underseasoning either. Ever since witnessing a series of underseasoning disasters at Chez Panisse, I've been obsessed with preventing it. There was the day a cook forgot to add salt to the pizza dough altogether, an accident we didn't notice until the taster, when nothing could be done but remove pizza from the menu. There was the time I braised chicken legs that had been marked salted but clearly were not, a mistake that went undiscovered until I pulled the chicken from the oven and tasted it. Since sprinkling the surface of cooked meat will do little to make up for the lack of seasoning within, the only thing we could do was shred the meat, season it, and turn it into a ragu to be served with pasta. The instance of underseasoning that made the biggest impression on me, though, was the time a very senior cook undersalted his lasagna, which he had already cut into 100 pieces for that night's service. Since salting the top would do little to correct a mistake that had been made from within, as the intern I was given the task of gingerly lifting each of the 12 layers on each of the 100 pieces of lasagna to sneak a few grains of salt into each one. After that, I've never underseasoned a lasagna. You will also inevitably oversalt. We all do. It might happen soon after you become a member of the newly converted, now awakened to the power of salt. You might grow cavalier like I did as a young cook with those pork roasts, and start to use so much salt you render everything inedible for a while. It could happen when you're simply not paying attention. It's not that big a deal. We all make mistakes from time to time. I certainly still do. There are a handful of fixes for oversalting, but none involves serving something terribly salty alongside something terribly bland. Intentional blandness won't ever cancel out oversalting. Dilute. Add more unseasoned ingredients to increase the total volume of the dish. More of anything that's unsalted will work to balance out with salted, but bland, starchy, and rich things are particularly helpful in these circumstances, because just a small amount of them can help balance out a relatively large amount of food. Add bland rice or potatoes to an overseasoned soup, or olive oil to an oversalted mayonnaise. While water evaporates from a boiling soup, stock, or sauce, salt won't, and what's left behind will be overly salty. The solution here is simple. Add more water or stock. If you overseason a dish made with many ingredients mixed together, add more of the main ingredient and adjust everything else until it's all balanced again. Have. If you've already put the dish together and diluting will yield more food than you'll be able to use, then divide the oversalted amount and correct only half of it. Depending on what it is, you may be able to refrigerate or freeze the rest until you can get around to adjusting and using it. Or you might have to face the sad reality of throwing it out. But that's better than using $30 worth of olive oil to correct a batch of mayonnaise and then only using a quarter of it. Balance. Sometimes, food that seems salty isn't actually oversalted. It just needs to be balanced with some acid or fat. Doctor up a spoonful of the dish with a few drops of lemon juice or vinegar, a little olive oil, or some of each. If it tastes better, then apply the changes to the whole batch. Select. Foods cooked in liquid, such as beans or braises, can often be salvaged if the salty cooking liquid is discarded. If the beans are too salty, change out the water. Make refried beans or turn the beans, but not their liquid, into soup, adding unseasoned broth and vegetables. If braised meat is just a little too salty, serve it without the liquid and try to balance it with a rich acidic condiment such as creme fraiche. Serve a lightly seasoned starch or starchy vegetable alongside it to act as a foil. Transform. Shred an oversalted piece of meat to turn it into a new dish where it's just one ingredient of many. A stew, chili, a soup, hash, ravioli filling. Add more salt to oversalted raw, flaky whitefish and turn it into bacala or salt cod. Admit defeat. Sometimes the best thing you can do is call it a loss and start over. Or order some pizza. It's okay. It's just dinner. You'll get another chance tomorrow. Never despair. View mistakes of under- or over-seasoning as opportunities for learning. Not long after my salt epiphany over polenta with Cal, I was tasked with making some corn custards for the vegetarian guests in the restaurant. It was the first time I was trusted with cooking an entire dish from start to finish. I could hardly believe that paying guests would be eating something I cooked. It was thrilling and terrifying all at once. I made the custard just as I'd been taught, cooking onions until soft, adding corn I'd stripped from the ears, steeping the cobs in cream to infuse it with sweet corn flavor, making a simple custard base with that cream and eggs, and then combining everything and gently baking it in a water bath until barely set. I was thrilled with how silky the custards had turned out, and toward the end of the night, the chef came by and tasted a spoonful. Seeing the hope in my eyes, he graciously told me I'd done a good job, and then gingerly added that next time I should increase the seasoning. Even though he delivered the criticism just about as gently as any chef ever could, I was floored and completely embarrassed. I'd been following all of the instructions for making the custard so intently that I'd completely forgotten the most important rule in our kitchen. One that I thought I'd already internalized, but clearly hadn't. Taste everything, every step of the way. I'd never tasted the onions, the corn, or the custard mixture. Not once. After that experience, tasting became reflexive in a whole new way. Within a few months, I was consistently cooking the most delicious food I'd ever made, and it was all because of a single tweak in my approach. I'd learned how to salt. Develop a sense for salt by tasting everything as you cook, early and often. Adopt the mantra, stir, taste, adjust. Make salt the first thing you notice as you taste and the last thing you adjust before serving a dish. When constant tasting becomes instinctive, you can begin to improvise. Improvising with salt. Cooking isn't so different from jazz. The best jazz musicians seem to improvise effortlessly, whether by embellishing standards or by stripping them down. Louis Armstrong could take an elaborate melody and distill it down to a single note on his horn, while Ella Fitzgerald could take an utterly simple tune and endlessly elaborate upon it with her extraordinary voice. But in order to be able to improvise flawlessly, they had to learn the basic language of music, the notes, and develop an intimate relationship with the standards. The same is true for cooking. While a great chef can make improvisation look easy, the ability to do so depends on a strong foundation of the basics. Salt, fat, acid, and heat are the building blocks of that foundation. Use them to develop a repertoire of basic dishes that you can cook anytime, anywhere. Eventually, like Louis or Ella, you'll be able to simplify or embellish your cooking at the drop of a pork pie hat. Begin by incorporating everything you've learned about salt into all of your cooking, from the casual frittata to the holiday roast. The three basic decisions involving salt are when, how much, in what form? Ask yourself these three questions every time you set out to cook. Their answers will begin to form a roadmap for improvisation. One day soon, you'll surprise yourself. It might be when, shortly after standing before a near-empty fridge, convinced you don't have the makings for anything worth eating, you discover a wedge of Parmesan. 20 minutes later, you could be tucking into the most perfectly seasoned bowl of pasta cacio e pepe you've ever tasted. Or it might be right after an unplanned shopping spree at the farmer's market with friends. Returning home with an abundance of produce, you'll lay it all out on the counter, pull the chicken you seasoned the night before out from the fridge, and preheat the oven without skipping a beat. Pouring your friends a glass of wine, you'll offer them a snack of a few sliced cucumbers and radishes sprinkled with flaky salt. Without a second thought, you'll add a palmful of salt to the boiling pot of water on the stove, then taste and adjust it before blanching the turnips and their greens. As your friends take their first bites, they'll ask you to share your culinary secrets. Tell them the truth. You've mastered using the most important element of good cooking, salt. Fat. Just after I began cooking at Chez Panisse, the chefs held a contest to see which employee could come up with the best tomato sauce recipe. There was only one rule. We had to use ingredients readily available in the restaurant's kitchen. The prize was $500 in cash and an acknowledgement on the menu each time the recipe would be used, forever. As a total novice, I was too intimidated to enter, but it seemed like everyone else, from the maitre d' to other bussers, porters, and of course the cooks, wanted to try. Dozens of entrants brought in their sauces for a blind tasting by a team of impartial judges, i.e. the chefs and Alice. Some sauces were seasoned with dried oregano, others fresh marjoram. Some entrants crushed their canned tomatoes by hand, while others painstakingly seeded and diced them. Others added chili flakes, while still others channeled their inner nonnas and pureed their sauces Pomerola style. It was tomato mayhem, and we were all a-twitter, waiting to hear who would be the winner. At one point, one of the chefs came into the kitchen to get a glass of water. We asked him how it was going. I'll never forget what he said. There are a lot of great entries. So many, in fact, that it's hard to narrow them down. But Alice's palate is so sensitive, she can't ignore that some of the best versions were made with rancid olive oil. Alice couldn't understand why everyone hadn't used the high-quality olive oil we cooked with at the restaurant, especially when it was always available to employees to buy at cost. I was shocked. Never before had it occurred to me that olive oil would have much effect on the flavor of a dish, much less one as piquant as tomato sauce. This was my first glimpse of understanding that as a foundational ingredient, the flavor of olive oil, and indeed any fat we choose to cook with, dramatically alters our perception of the entire dish. Just as an onion cooked in butter tastes different from an onion cooked in olive oil, an onion cooked in good olive oil tastes different, and in this case better, than one cooked in a poorer quality oil. My friend Mike, another young cook, ended up winning the contest. His recipe was so complicated I can hardly remember it all these years later. But I'll never forget the lesson I learned that day. Food can only ever be as delicious as the fat with which it's cooked. While I was taught to appreciate the flavors of various oils at Chez Panisse, it wasn't until I worked in Italy that I saw fat as an important and versatile element of cooking on its own, rather than simply a cooking medium. During the olive harvest, or raccolta, I made a pilgrimage to Tenuta di Capezzana, the producer of the most exquisite olive oil I'd ever tasted. Standing in the frantoio, I watched rapt as the day's olive harvest was transformed into a yellow-green elixir so bright it seemed to illuminate the dark Tuscan night. The oil's flavor was as astonishing as its color, peppery, almost acidic, in a way I never imagined a fat could be. The following autumn, I was in Liguria, a coastal province, during the raccolta. Olio Nuovo pressed on the shores of the Mediterranean was wholly different. This oil was buttery, low in acid, and so rich I wanted to swallow spoonfuls of it. I learned that where olive oil comes from has a huge effect on how it tastes. Oil from hot, dry, hilly areas is spicy, while oil from coastal climates with milder weather is correspondingly milder in flavor. After tasting the oils, I could see how a peppery oil would overwhelm a delicate preparation such as fish tartare, while the more subtle flavor of a coastal oil might not be able to stand up to the bold flavors of a Tuscan bistecca served with bitter greens. At Zibibbo, Benedetta Vitali's Florentine Trattoria, We used peppery Tuscan extra virgin olive oil more liberally than any other ingredient. We used it to make salad dressings. We used it to drench the dough for the focaccia we baked each morning. We used it to brown sofrito, the aromatic base of onions, carrots, and celery at the foundation of all of our long-cooked foods. We used it to deep-fry everything from squid to squash blossoms to bomboloni, the cream-filled donuts I ate with gusto every Saturday morning. Tuscan olive oil defined the flavor of our cooking. Our food tasted delicious because our olive oil was delicious. As I traveled throughout Italy, I saw how fat determines the particular flavors of regional cooking. In the north, where pastures and the dairy cattle they sustain are abundant, cooks use butter, cream, and rich cheeses readily in dishes such as polenta, tagliatelle bolognese, and risotto. In the south and on the coasts, where olive trees flourish, olive oil is used in everything from seafood dishes to pastas and even desserts, such as olive oil gelato. Because pigs can be raised in just about any climate, though, one thing unites the diverse regional Italian cuisines: pork fat. As I immersed myself in the culture and cuisine of Italy, one thing became clear. Italians' remarkable relationship to fat is essential to why their food tastes so good. Fat, then, I realized, is the second element of good cooking. What is fat? The best way to appreciate the value of fat in the kitchen is to try to imagine cooking without it. What would vinaigrette be without olive oil, sausage without pork fat, a baked potato without sour cream, a croissant without butter? Pointless, that's what. Without the flavors and textures that fat makes possible, food would be immeasurably less pleasurable to eat. In other words, fat is essential for achieving the full spectrum of flavors and textures of good cooking. Besides being one of the four basic elements of good cooking, fat is also one of the four elemental building blocks of all foods, along with water, protein, and carbohydrates. While it's commonly believed that fat, much like salt, is universally unhealthy, both elements are essential to human survival. Fat serves as a crucial backup energy source, a way to store energy for future use, and plays a role in nutrient absorption and essential metabolic functions, such as brain growth. Unless you've been directed by your doctor to strictly reduce your fat consumption, you don't need to worry. There's nothing unhealthy about cooking with moderate amounts of fat, especially if you favor healthy plant and fish-based fats. As with salt, my aim isn't so much to get you to use more fat as it is to teach you how to make better use of it in your cooking. In contrast to salt, fat takes on many forms and is derived from many sources. While salt is a mineral, used primarily to enhance flavor, fat plays three distinct roles in the kitchen: as a main ingredient, as a cooking medium, and like salt, as seasoning. The same type of fat can play different roles in your cooking, depending on how it is used. The first step in choosing a fat to use is to identify the primary role it will play in a dish. Used as a main ingredient, fat will significantly affect a dish. Often, it's both a source of rich flavor and of a particular desired texture. For example, fat ground into a burger will render as it cooks, basting the meat from within and contributing to juiciness. Butter inhibits the proteins in flour from developing, yielding tender and flaky textures in a pastry. Olive oil contributes both a light, grassy flavor and a rich texture to pesto. The amount of cream and egg yolks in an ice cream determine just how smooth and decadent it'll be. Hint: the more cream and eggs, the creamier the result. The role fat plays as a cooking medium is perhaps its most impressive and unique. Cooking fats can be heated to extreme temperatures, allowing the surface temperature of foods cooked in them to climb to astonishing heights as well. In the process, these foods become golden brown and develop the crisp crusts that so please our palates. Any fat you heat to cook food can be described as a medium, whether it's the peanut oil in which you fry chicken, the butter you use to sauté spring vegetables, or the olive oil in which you poach tuna. Certain fats can also be used as seasoning to adjust flavor or enrich the texture of a dish just before serving. A few drops of toasted sesame oil will deepen the flavors in a bowl of rice. a dollop of sour cream will offer silky richness to a cup of soup. A little mayonnaise spread on a BLT will increase its succulence. And a smear of cultured butter on a piece of crusty bread will add untold richness. To determine which role fat is playing in a dish, ask yourself these questions. Will this fat bind various ingredients together? If so, this is a main ingredient. Does this fat play a textural role? For flaky, creamy, and light textures, fat plays the role of main ingredient, while for crisp textures, it's a cooking medium. For tender textures, fat can play either role. Will this fat be heated and used to cook the food? If so, this is a cooking medium. Does this fat play a flavor role? If it's added at the outset, it's a main ingredient. If it's used to adjust flavor or texture at the end of cooking the dish as a garnish, it's a seasoning. Once you've identified which role fat will play in a dish, you'll be better equipped to choose which fat to use and how to cook food that will result in the taste and texture you're after. Fat and flavor. Fat's effect on flavor. Put simply, fat carries flavor. While certain fats have their own distinct flavors, any fat can convey aromas and enhance flavors to our palates that would otherwise go unnoticed. Fat coats the tongue, allowing various aromatic compounds to stay in contact with our taste buds for longer periods of time, intensifying and prolonging our experience of various flavors. Peel and slice 2 cloves of garlic. Gently sizzle 1 clove in a couple tablespoons of water and the other in the same amount of olive oil. Taste a few drops of each liquid. You'll have a much more powerful impression of the garlic flavor in oil. Take advantage of this capability to intensify and circulate flavor by adding aromatics directly into the cooking fat. When baking, add vanilla extract and other flavorings directly into the butter or egg yolks for the same result. Fat enhances flavor in another extraordinary way. Because cooking fats can withstand temperatures well beyond the boiling point of water, 212 degrees Fahrenheit at sea level, they perform a crucial task that water cannot, the facilitation of surface browning, which typically does not begin at temperatures below 230 degrees Fahrenheit. In some foods, browning will introduce entirely new flavors, including nuttiness, sweetness, meatiness, earthiness, and savoriness, umami. Imagine the difference in flavor between a poached chicken breast and one browned on the stove in a little olive oil, and the incalculable value of this attribute will be clear. The flavors of fat. Different fats have different flavors. To select the right fat, get to know how each fat tastes and in which cuisines it's commonly used. Olive oil. Olive oil is a staple in Mediterranean cooking, so make it your default fat when cooking foods inspired by Italian, Spanish, Greek, Turkish, North African, and Middle Eastern cuisines. It shines as a medium for everything from soups and pastas to braises, roasted meats, and vegetables. Use it as a main ingredient in mayonnaise, vinaigrette, and all manner of condiments from herb salsa to chili oil. Drizzle it over beef carpaccio or baked ricotta as a seasoning. Your food will taste good if you start with a good-tasting olive oil, but choosing the right one can be daunting. At my local market alone, there are 2 dozen brands of extra virgin olive oil on display. Then, there are all the virgin, pure, and flavored oils. Early in my cooking career, as I approached these aisles, I often found myself overwhelmed by choices. Virgin or extra virgin? Italy or France? Organic or not? Is that olive oil on sale any good? Why is one brand $30 for 750 milliliters while another is $10 for a liter? As with wine, taste, not price, is the best guide to choosing an olive oil. This might require an initial leap of faith, but the only way to learn the vocabulary of olive oil is to taste and pay attention. Descriptors like fruity, pungent, spicy, and bright might seem confusing at first, but a good olive oil, like a good wine, is multidimensional. If you taste something expensive but don't like it, then it's not for you. If you find a $10 bottle that's delicious, then you've scored. While it's a challenge to explain what good olive oil tastes like, it's fairly simple to describe a bad one. Bitter, overwhelmingly spicy, dirty, rancid, all deal breakers. Color has little to do with the quality of olive oil, and it offers no clues to whether an olive oil is rancid. Instead, use your nose and palate. Does the olive oil smell like a box of crayons, candle wax, or the oil floating on top of an old jar of peanut butter? If so, it's rancid. The sad truth is that most Americans accustomed to the taste of rancid olive oil actually prefer it. And so most of the huge olive oil producers are happy to sell to us what more discerning buyers would reject. Olive oil is produced seasonally. Look for a production date, typically in November, on the label when you purchase a bottle to ensure you are buying a current pressing. It will go rancid about 12 to 14 months after it's been pressed, so don't save it for a special occasion, thinking it will improve over time like a fine wine. In this way, olive oil is nothing like wine. As with salt, there are various categories of olive oils: everyday oils, finishing oils, and flavored oils. Use everyday olive oils for general cookery and finishing olive oils for applications where you really want to let the flavor of the olive oil stand out. In salad dressings, spooned over fish tartare, in herb salsas, or in olive oil cakes. Purchase and use flavored olive oils with caution. Flavorings are often added to mask the taste of low-quality olive oils, so I generally recommend staying away from them. But there is an exception. Olive oils marked agrumato are made using a traditional technique of milling whole citrus fruit with the olives at the time of the first press. At Byright Creamery in San Francisco, one of the most popular sundaes features bergamot agrumato drizzled over chocolate ice cream, and it is delicious. It can be difficult to find a good, affordable, everyday olive oil in grocery stores. My standbys include the extra virgin oils from Seca Hills, Katz, and California Olive Ranch. Another good everyday oil is the Kirkland Signature Organic Extra Virgin Oil from Costco, which regularly scores well on independently administered quality analyses. In their absence, look for oils that are produced from 100% Californian or Italian olives, as opposed to those with labels that simply read made in Italy, packed in Italy, or bottled in Italy, which imply that the oil is pressed in Italy from olives whose provenance cannot be traced or guaranteed. The production date should always be clearly marked on the label. If you can't track down a good, affordable, everyday olive oil, instead of using a lower quality one, make your own blend of good olive oil and a neutral tasting cold-pressed grapeseed or canola oil. Save the pure stuff and use it as a finishing oil for salads and condiments. Once you find an olive oil you love, take good care of it. Constant temperature fluctuations from a nearby stove or daily brushes with the sun's rays will encourage olive oil to go rancid. So store it somewhere reliably cool and dark. If you can't keep it in a dark place, store olive oil in a dark glass bottle or metal can to keep light out. Butter. Butter is a common cooking fat in regions with climates that support pasture for grazing cows, throughout the US and Canada, the UK and Ireland, Scandinavia, Western Europe, including Northern Italy, and Russia, Morocco, and India. One of the most versatile fats, butter can be manipulated into several forms and used as either a cooking medium, main ingredient, or seasoning. In its natural state, butter is available salted and unsalted, and cultured. Salted and tangy cultured butters are best as is, spread on warm toast or served with radishes and sea salt as an hors d'oeuvre. There is no way to know exactly how much salt is in any one particular brand of salted butter, so use unsalted butter when cooking and baking, and add your own salt to taste. Chilled or at room temperature, unsalted butter can be worked into doughs and batters as a main ingredient to lend its rich dairy flavor to baked goods and produce a variety of luxurious textures, from flaky to tender to light. Unlike oil, butter is not pure fat. It also contains water, milk protein, and whey solids, which provide much of its flavor. Gently heat unsalted butter until those solids brown and you get brown butter, which is nutty and sweet. Brown butter is a classic flavor in French and Northern Italian cooking, particularly apt for pairing with hazelnuts, winter squash, and sage, as I like to do in autumn panzanella, which is dressed with a brown butter vinaigrette. Melt unsalted butter gently over sustained low heat to clarify it. The whey proteins will rise to the top of the clear yellow fat, and other milk proteins will fall to the bottom. The water will evaporate, leaving behind 100% fat. Skim the whey solids and save them to toss with fettuccine. The buttery flavor is an ideal complement to the eggy noodles, especially if you top the dish with grated Parmesan and freshly ground black pepper. Since the proteins can sneak through even the finest cheesecloth, take care to leave them undisturbed at the bottom of the pot. Carefully strain the rest of the butter through cheesecloth to yield clarified butter, which is an excellent medium for high-heat cooking. I love using clarified butter for frying potato cakes. With the solids removed, the butter doesn't burn, and the potatoes take on all of that buttery goodness. Indian ghee is simply clarified butter that's been cooked at a higher temperature, allowing the milk solids to brown and lending the finished fat a sweeter flavor. Smen, used to fluff Moroccan couscous, is clarified butter that has been buried underground for up to 7 years to develop a cheesy taste. Seed and nut oils. Almost every culture relies on a neutral-tasting seed or nut oil because cooks don't always want fat to flavor a dish. Peanut oil, expeller-pressed canola oil, and grapeseed oil are all good choices as cooking fats precisely because they don't taste like anything. Since they have high smoke points, these oils can also withstand the high temperatures required to crisp and brown foods. Spreading a rumor of tropical flavor to any dish where it's used, coconut oil tastes particularly good in granola, or as the cooking fat for roasted root vegetables. Coconut oil is also the rare vegetable oil that's solid at room temperature. Continue listening to learn how solid fat is a boon for making flaky pastries, and use coconut oil to make a pie crust the next time your lactose intolerant friend comes over for dinner. Cook's tip: both skin and hair readily absorb coconut oil, so it makes for a fantastic luxury treatment whenever you're feeling dry. Specialty seed and nut oils with vibrant flavors can be used as seasonings. Fry leftover rice in toasted sesame oil with an egg and kimchi for a Korean-inspired snack. A little toasted hazelnut oil in a vinaigrette will amplify a simple arugula and hazelnut salad with an echo of nuttiness. Garnish pumpkin soup with an herb salsa pumped up with toasted pumpkin seeds and a drizzle of pumpkin seed oil to incorporate multiple dimensions of a single ingredient. Animal fats. All meat-eating cultures make use of animal fats, which can be incorporated into food as a main ingredient, cooking medium, or seasoning, depending on its form. Most aromatic molecules are repelled by water, so in meat, they're predominantly found in an animal's fat. As a result, any animal's fat will taste much more distinctly of that animal than its lean meat. Beef fat tastes beefier than steak. Pork fat tastes porkier than pork. Chicken fat tastes more chickeny than chicken, and so on. Beef. When solid, it's called suet. Liquid, it's called tallow. Beef fat is a crucial component in hamburgers and hot dogs, lending beefy flavor and enhancing moistness. Without suet, or another added fat, a hamburger would be dry, crumbly, and tasteless. Tallow is often used for frying French fries and cooking Yorkshire pudding, a giant popover traditionally served with prime rib. Pork. When solid, it's called pork fat. Liquid, it's called lard. Pork fat is an important addition to sausages and terrines, providing both flavor and richness. Use solid pork fat for barding and larding, two hilariously named terms for supplementing lean meats with solid fat to keep them from drying out. Barding is the term for covering lean meat with slices of pork belly, either smoked and called bacon, cured and called pancetta, or left unadulterated, to protect it from the dry heat of roasting. While larding refers to the act of threading pieces of fat through a lean piece of meat with a long, thick needle. Both processes add richness and flavor. Since it has a high smoke point, Lard is a terrific cooking medium and is commonly used in Mexico, the American South, southern Italy, and the northern Philippines. It can also be used as an ingredient in doughs, though it should be used with care, because while it makes for a perfectly flaky empanada dough, its distinctly porky taste may not always be desirable in your blueberry pie. Chicken, duck, and goose. These fats are only used in their liquid forms as cooking media. Schmaltz, or rendered chicken fat, is a traditional ingredient in the Jewish kitchen. I love sizzling rice in it to lend it some chickeny flavor. Save duck or goose fat that renders when roasting a bird, strain it, and use it to fry potatoes or root vegetables. Few things are tastier than potatoes fried in duck fat. Lamb. Also called suet, it's generally not rendered, but it is an important ingredient in lamb sausages such as merguez in countries where pork is not consumed. Fats of the world. Just as I discovered in Italy, cuisines are distinguished by their fats. Since fat is the foundation of so many dishes, choose culturally appropriate fats to flavor food from within. Use the wrong fat and food will never taste right, no matter how carefully you use other seasonings. Don't use olive oil when cooking Vietnamese food or smoky bacon fat when making Indian food. Instead, refer to the fat flavor wheel in the accompanying PDF to guide your decision-making as you cook foods from around the world. Sauté garlicky green beans in butter to serve with a French-inspired meal, in ghee to serve alongside Indian rice and lentils, or with a splash of sesame oil to serve with glazed five-spice chicken. How fat works. Which fats we use primarily affect flavor, but how we use them will determine texture, which is just as important in good cooking. Varied textures excite our palates. By transforming foods from soft and moist to crisp and crunchy, we introduce new textures and make the experience of eating more amusing, surprising, and delicious. Depending on how we use fats, we can achieve any one of five distinct textures in our food: crisp, creamy, flaky, tender, and light. Crisp. Humans love crisp and crunchy foods. According to Chef Mario Batali, the word crispy sells more food than almost any other adjective. Crisp foods stoke our appetites by conjuring up past experiences of foods with pleasing aromas, tastes, and sounds. Just think of fried chicken, a version of which you'll encounter in practically any country around the world. Few moments in a meal can rival that first bite of chicken, fried so expertly that the skin shatters the moment your teeth sink into it. Steam ripe with the mouth-watering aromas of that crisp batter, a loud, attention-grabbing crunch, and the comforting flavors of fried chicken all emerge simultaneously to deliver that universal experience of deliciousness. For food to become crisp, the water trapped in its cells must evaporate. Water evaporates as it boils, so the surface temperature of the ingredient must climb beyond the boiling point of 212 degrees Fahrenheit. To achieve this effect on the entire surface of the food, it needs to be in direct, even contact with a heat source, such as a pan at temperatures well beyond water's boiling point. But no food is perfectly smooth, and at the microscopic level, most pans aren't either. In order to get even contact between the food and the pan, we need a medium, fat. Cooking fats can be heated to 350 degrees Fahrenheit and beyond before beginning to smoke, so they are ideal media for developing the crisp, golden crusts that delight our palates so much. Cooking methods where fat is heated to achieve crispness include searing, sautéing, pan, shallow, and deep frying. A bonus, using enough fat to create even surface contact will prevent food from sticking to the pan. As with salt, I encourage you to abandon any fear of fat, for knowing how to use fat properly may lead you to use less of it. The best way to know how much fat to use is to pay attention to certain sensory cues. Some ingredients, such as eggplant and mushrooms, act like sponges, quickly absorbing fat and then cooking dry against the hot metal. Using too little fat in a pan, or letting the fat be absorbed and neglecting to add more, will result in dark, bitter blisters on the surface of the food. Other ingredients, such as pork chops or chicken thighs, will release their own fat as they cook. Walk away from a pan of sizzling bacon for a few minutes and you'll return to see the strips practically submerged in their own fat. Let your eyes, ears, and taste buds guide you in how much fat to use. Recipes can be a useful starting point, but conditions vary from kitchen to kitchen, depending on the tools available to you. Say a recipe asks you to cook 2 diced onions in 2 tablespoons of olive oil. In a small pan, that might be enough to coat the bottom, but in a larger pan with greater surface area, it probably isn't. Instead of just following a recipe, use your common sense too. For example, make sure that the bottom of the pan is coated with fat when sautéing, or that oil comes halfway up the sides of the food when shallow frying. Food cooked in too much fat is no more appetizing than its inverse. Few things can retroactively ruin a meal like a puddle of grease left on an otherwise empty plate. Drain fried foods, even pan or shallow fried foods, with a quick dab on a clean dish towel or paper napkin before serving. And lift sautéed foods out of the pan with a slotted spoon or tongs rather than tilting them out onto a plate to leave the excess fat behind. While you're cooking, if you notice you've used more fat than you'd intended, you can tip the excess out of the pan, taking care to wipe its outer edge where fat may have dripped to prevent a flare-up. Just do it carefully so you don't burn yourself. If the pan is too heavy or hot, then be smart. Take the food out and use tongs to place it on a plate. Then tip some of the fat out, replace the food, and continue cooking. It's not worth a burn or a grease spill to avoid washing an extra dish. Heating oil properly. Preheat the pan to reduce the amount of time fat spends in direct contact with the hot metal, minimizing opportunity for it to deteriorate. As oil is heated, it breaks down, leading to flavor degradation and the release of toxic chemicals. Food is also more likely to stick to a cold pan, another reason to preheat. But exceptions to the preheating rule exist: butter and garlic. Both will burn if the pan is too hot, so you must heat them gently. In all other cooking, preheat the pan and then add the fat, letting it too heat up before adding any other ingredients. The pan should be hot enough so that oil immediately ripples and shimmers when added. Various metals conduct heat at different rates, so there's no set amount of time to recommend. Instead, test the pan with a drop of water. If it crackles a little bit before evaporating, it doesn't have to be a violent sound, then the pan is ready. A general clue that both the pan and fat are hot enough is the sound of a delicate sizzle upon addition of the food. If you add food too early and don't get that sizzle, just take the food out, let the pan heat up sufficiently, and put it back in to ensure it doesn't stick or overcook before it browns. Rendering. Intermuscular and subcutaneous fats, the lumpy bits between the muscles and the layer of fat just beneath the skin, can be cut into small pieces, placed in a pan with a minimal amount of water, and rendered, or cooked over gentle heat until all the water has evaporated. This process transforms solid fat into a liquid that can be used as a cooking medium. The next time you roast a duck, trim all of its excess fat before cooking and render it. Strain it into a glass jar and store it in the fridge. It'll keep for up to 6 months. Save it to make chicken confit. While fat in meat is a great boon to flavor, it can also prevent meat from crisping. Even when the aim is not to render fat to use as a cooking medium, this technique is crucial for transforming texture. Crisp bacon is the happy result of properly rendered fat. Fry at too high a temperature and it'll burn on the outside while remaining flabby. The key is to cook it slowly enough to allow the fat to render at the same rate the bacon browns. Since animal fats begin to burn at around 350 degrees Fahrenheit, try arranging sliced bacon in a single layer on a baking sheet and then slipping it into an oven set to that temperature. The heat of the oven will be gentler and more even than on the stove, giving the fat an opportunity to render. Or when cooking bits of bacon or pancetta on the stove, start with a little water in the pan to help moderate